Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So I'd like to thank Rev. Master Mayan for inviting me to say a few words at this time. I won't keep us long because I realize we have a meal to prepare and enjoy. I noticed after composing my talk that I mentioned some dates and time spans. I'm not very good at dates in the past and time, so if I get some of it a bit wrong, if you could just bear with me and roll with it. And I also noticed that I use some of my favorite images and analogies, some of them I've used recently, so if you've heard them before, maybe you can hear them with fresh ears as best you can. So, as we know, Rev. Master Jiu passed away 20 years ago to the day. And she did it as she said she hoped she would be able to, and that is to do it as one would pass simply through a doorway. And that's, you know, that's how it happened. She had a cold, as I recall, and I don't know whether it was congestive heart failure or not, but she was sitting in your chair and just faded away very peacefully. It was about 54 years ago that she set off for the Far East from England. And when I think about what she did in the context in which she did it, I tend to contrast it against the context of my own processing, of my own practice, which for me meant going to the monastery here and eventually becoming a monk. At that time for me, meditation was coming to the college campuses, so I got my mantra along with, you know, a bunch of other people, with my handful of flowers and $35. And I still haven't told anyone what my mantra is because I said I wouldn't. And I won't. as I said, meditation was being talked about. There were popular books on Eastern thought that were becoming more and more abundant, and within my own peers, we were having conversations about spirituality and human experience other than the mainstream norm. So we would talk about things, and in general, the Eastern thought and associated spirituality was entering the popular culture, although of course now, you know, it's more normal, but at least among my circles, it was kind of more or less normal or becoming normal. So the crazy idea I had of going to a monastery was understood by my peers, although most of them had no interest in doing the same. So I had to go alone. There are certain alone things we can only do alone in life, and often, sitting in a wall is something that ultimately it's something we do in a solitary way, although if we're lucky, there are others around us who can encourage us. So I had to row my own boat. But fortunately, the waters in which I was rowing, the cultural waters, if you like, were flowing, maybe just gently, but at least were flowing in the direction that I wanted to go. The path of spirituality was seen as a positive one, and you know, I had support, I felt supported. Also, there was a place where I could take my next step within my own culture. There weren't many places at the time. There was the Rochester Zen Center, which I went to. Three Pillars of Zen had been out for a few years and was a very popular popular book. And I went to a religion professor and said, "Well, I want to go someplace. What could he suggest?" And he said, "Well, I have this journal that these folks sent me. I don't know anything about them, but it was one of the early journals, maybe even the first, one of the ones that were cracked off in a mimeograph machine. And I think it was the one that had the picture of the monks." Staged picture of the monk sitting next to a 6-foot, snow drifts. Anyway, I asked if I could come. I had read somewhere in some book that it takes 20 years to, come to any significant understanding. So, I knew this wasn't going to be a weekend or, endeavor. So I was pretty much prepared, for the long haul, in terms of this is what I'm going to do with my life for the foreseeable future. And interestingly enough, it was after about 20 years that I began to see changes in myself that were in line with what I was hoping, I could accomplish. I sometimes think maybe I should have read a book where it said it only takes 5 years, Could have been a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. but in Reverend Master Jiyu's case, Buddhism and genuine Buddhist practice was probably not in the culture, in the air, as it was for me. I wasn't there, so I can only speculate on these things. So she was probably more alone in her processing. What she might have shared with her peers might have been unknown to them or, just way out there. And she did go to a different culture, whereas I didn't. I just had to get in a plane for a few hours. So for her, it was much more a stepping off into the unknown, foreign language, a whole different level of risk than I had, and probably took a lot more courage than I might have had in her shoes. I had the opportunity to have tea with the community of Amaravati in the UK, of the Thai forest tradition, and Ajahn Sumedho was still there as their abbot. He was an American who went to Asia in about 1964 and was eventually ordained as a full monk in the Thai tradition. And I commented to him that he too was something of a pioneer, much more of a sense of stepping out of the norm, mainstream norm, risk than I had to make. So in any case, Reverend Master Jiyu ended up in post-war Japan, a Westerner, the only woman in a male monastery. And I don't know if those of you who noticed in that one of the pictures we had last night, and that's in the current memorial journal of monks after a session at Sojiji with rows and rows of monks. I counted up about 150 monks, all male, and one... Well, actually, two female. One monk, female monk's face, kind of in the middle of it, and a couple rows behind Ko Zenji, who was beaming. Most of them weren't beaming. They were all, very serious. But Ko Zenji, he always seems to be beaming happily in many of the pictures that you see of him. There was one other woman in the picture, and whether she was worked for the temple or was one of the wives or one of the priests, I don't know. But in any case, she was the only monk amongst the sea of male trainees, and it really just sort of brings to home the reality, of what she was doing. We have her diaries that eventually were turned into the Wild White Goose. And I remember reading the Goose here and there about conversations she'd have with with Reverend Hajime, I think he's mentioned in the Goose, where she'd ask a question and he'd answer. And, you know, some of the questions and answers were, you know, were kind of startling. And it was interesting because Reverend Master Khotan is doing her biography. He's been going over the journals, and I was able to see some of those journals in her hand where she'd write the question, and in his hand where he'd write the answer exactly, you know, as she reported in the Goose. And it, again, it just brought it home, you know, to the reality of what she did. And just said, you know, this is what happened, you know. One of her key decisions was to take everything for her own good. Whatever came her way, she tried to see it as teaching and learn from it. And for someone who does that, the gates open wide. You spend not so much time thinking about or judging the training of others, but focus on our own minds and study of what catches us, what binds us, what leads to unhappiness, what causes our own suffering. One can go very far if you adopt that as an approach. It doesn't mean we're passive participants in the process, ignorant and unthinking about what goes on around us, because we are thinking beings. We have the capacity to conceptualize, make within the limits of our own perceptions, which often aren't full or perfect, honest assessments about right and wrong. I don't know whether we can even turn that function off, but I certainly was never asked to. I was never asked to abandon my rational mind. However, what is important is the relationship we have with the stuff of the mind, where we sit in the midst of it. If we sit in a place of stillness and composure where we can ask, what is good to do here? Is that where we sit, or are we dragged around by our emotional reactions, our judgments, judgmentalism, and other forms of conditioning? So meditation is one way to grow this place of composure. And growing that is one of the effects of meditation, cultivating that sitting place and the ability to act from it. Now, I will be referring to meditation, you know, as I continue to talk, and I just wanted to kind of take a little sidestep and say meditation is a phrase, a word that's out there, you know, quite a bit now, but it's a bit like exercise in terms of its meaning. Someone can say, I'm exercising, and, you know, you don't imagine them sitting in a couch, you know, with their feet up, eating bonbons and watching television. You're pretty sure they're not doing that, although maybe they could be doing isometrics, you know, like that. But you kind of have a sense of what they're not doing. But exactly what they're doing, whether they're jogging or whatever, you know, you don't really know exactly what they're doing. And meditation is like that. There are all sorts of forms of meditation. So when someone says they're meditating, it's, okay, I have a vague sense of what they're not doing. But exactly what they're doing, you know, I don't know. And when I refer to meditation here, I'm normally referring to the type of practice that we do, which is simply sitting and letting go of whatever we're aware of, and letting things come and go without judgment and without grasping for any state of mind. And I'll just leave it there just to get people in the ballpark who might be hearing this and don't know, you know, what I mean by meditation. Rinpoche Master Jiu made countless efforts to keep the focus of our common practice on the practice and perfection of Zazen. As such, there were things that he chose not to incorporate into our practice, too many outside activities, or things that might be called the Zen arts, tea ceremony, flower arrangement, calligraphy, that sort of thing. Not that these things can't be vehicles for practice, as can anything, really. And I think probably, my opinion is that there were two main reasons why she didn't incorporate these things. One is that daily life offered us so many, you know, unavoidable opportunities for practice that we didn't need to find anything to add to it. Remember, we were building a monastery from scratch and learning how to do that. You know, we weren't carpenters and plumbers and electricians before we came. You know, we had to sort of scramble to figure all that out before we came, although some did have some skills. And also the Zen arts, there's a cultural aspect to these arts, which for some can have a bit of a mystique, in which one can get entangled and not realize that the important aspect of Zen practice, or what is important in Zen practice, is more fundamental than what you are doing. It has more to do with how you do it, and that can be anything. And as an art, there's the potential for attachment by the artist and a distraction from looking straight into the unknown, the non-clinging of body and mind that is absolute and from which nothing is exempt. The letting go of that which we name as ourselves and the infinite number of things outside of ourselves that we name and define and thereby limit in their ultimate meaning by defining what they are and at the same time what they are not. One way to talk about meditation is to say that we simply lay down the naming process. Can you simply walk without naming your action as walking? Can you see something without naming it in your own mind as a chair or a tree? If you do not name it, what is your relationship with it? I remember something that I read a couple years ago about the vision of cats, which was interesting to me because it seemed to point something out about human, how the human mind works. And I've looked repeatedly to find it, you know, so that to make sure that I wasn't completely making it up or just turning it into something for my own purposes when in fact that's not what it actually said. But it had to do with their vision and how it is evolved for the purpose of detecting movement. Apparently, we can see fine movements of things that to a cat, the thing looks not moving. It has to move 10 times faster for them than it does for us, for them to recognize that it's moving. Which might explain something about, you know how when a cat sees something moving, it, you know, it'll sort of, you know how it moves its head like that, it's like, oh my God, you know, oh my God, you know, that things are happening, but there's something that happens that makes it kind of pop into existence in a way that it wasn't there before, at least in terms of its own awareness. There's some kind of change that happens outside of themselves that one thing turns into another that allows some sort of comparison to be made that allows it then to come into existence by these two things, you know, being compared. But they don't see it for what it is until this change happens and the opposing elements can contrast against each other. And then the thing, as I said, comes into a certain kind of existence, at least into their awareness. And I think the human mind is kind of the opposite. We can look at something and name it. We can say, this lectern is not the chair. Its brownness is not blackness. It's tall, it's not short. And we can, by our minds moving, we create these sort of opposites and comparisons and dualities out of which the thing in terms of our awareness and perception of it existing comes into being. Not by externals changing. We, our mind, moves inside us. Buddhism offers, as most religions offer, some explanation as to how the universe came into existence. One of them can be found in the Sharangama Sutra. And when you read it, it's obviously not talking about how the planets formed and this and that. It's talking about how the here and now, as we experience it, comes into being. And to boil it down to, you know, to boil it down, it says thinking creates the thinker, and then essentially everything else tumbles out after that. By the ability of our mind to contrast and compare and to not be just still and not just seeing something, but we look at it and we figure out what it is by our mind moving in our conceptual world. There's a well-known story of two monks arguing. They see a flapping flag, whether the flag is moving or whether the wind is moving. And the master said, you know, it's the mind that's moving. And to me, that points to that, how there's something we do that creates, you know, reality as we experience it. And this is not just philosophy. It's a deeply significant point of Buddhism that can be confirmed by one's own experience. And it has to do with the fundamental nature of how of our personal existence, our experience, the reality that is created by the way we use our own minds. Of course, the more you realize that, the more you have the ability to change the nature of your experience. So when you simply see something, a tree, for example, I don't know, I'm stuck on trees, but maybe I was looking out at trees when I was writing my talk. You see a tree without naming it as a tree. Is there a relationship between two, you and the tree? Or is there just being? Is there just being which we don't have to name? We don't have to name. We just let it be. Not even name it as being. There is one within you that has no need to name and define, but for whom naming and knowing arise and pass naturally, provisionally as needed in the course of daily life. But because this one has not named the present moment as lacking and truth as something to be gained, there is freedom from the longing for experience other than what is here and now. There is nothing to grasp after. For Master Jiyu had a little plaque that had the motto of where she went to college, Durham, that said, that which is true is greater than that which is holy. Which is an excellent motto. But it was never one that she pointed to as the pinnacle of understanding, or beyond which there are no questions. Yes, that which is true is greater than that which is holy. In an academic setting, it makes perfect sense. In a Zen setting, one would have to ask, what is true? What is greater than that which is true? And I would say, what this points to is release from the need to know, the need to be, the need to have, and to name them as knowing, being, and having. When there is not the need, then there can arise knowing, being, and having. But we don't abandon our sitting place, which is nowhere, since we have no need to name it. So how can simply not naming, not clinging, just letting go to whatever arises do much? You know, it's not getting in there and figuring things out. No, we want to get in there and figure things out. Which brings us to one of the core aspects of our practice, the belief in our common underlying Buddha nature, underlying enlightened nature, and the faith that it is there, and that this remarkably unsophisticated practice can help us dissolve what seems to be keeping us from living from that place. I don't know how meditation works. You know, we're all sort of black boxes. You know, you can take a machine apart and see what gear's turning adjacent gear, but you can't do that with a person. So there's a whole mysterious aspect of it to me. But I'll offer a mechanical analogy that seems to fit as best as a mechanical analogy can, when you've got kind of the known on one hand and a mystery on the other. Imagine you come home one day and on your table you see a set of balancing scales, you know, like the just scales of justice, where these two tilting in two pans, you know, with weights, and there's some weights on one side and it's down like that, and a little note that says balance me, and a pile of weights on the other side. And you say, okay. And you start putting weights on the other side, and you know, it does that, and you take some off that and does that, and you just keep trying it. Then you read the note again, you see a little fine print. This scale is accurate to the weight of one atom. And you think, gosh, just breathing on the thing sprays it with atoms. You know, what the heck am I going to do? Life can be like that. We're going along quite happily, and then, for some reason, life becomes more complicated. We lose the directness and innocence that we seem to have had. We live more and more in our heads. We don't like things about ourselves, our greeds or our fears or our angers. We don't like things about other people or what's going on around us. We want what we don't have physically or materially, or what we think we lack spiritually. So we've lost a sense of unity, innocent unity that we had up to that point. So we ourselves are out of balance, and we want to resolve that out of balanceness, and we may have a very deep longing to find that balance again. And it usually involves making some part of us go away that we don't like, or making some part of us that we'd like to be, you know, appear. We usually sort of swing back and forth in the opposites. If we notice that we're too stingy and greedy, well, we may, you know, give all our stuff away. I'm reminded of the comedy skit. It could have been a Monty Python, where who is it? Robin Hood type character has taken from the rich, and there's a poor person that says, I'm poor, and he says, here. Then the poor person says, I'm rich, and he says, give me that, you know. So, so often the things we try just kind of go too far, don't quite, you know, just don't quite work out. So we try putting things on one side or the other of our scale, you know, to balance us out. And it usually involves thinking about one thing or another or acting on some assumptions about if I do this, then I'll get that. You know, there'll be that on the other side of the scale, which, you know, which is what I want, and then I'll be in balance. But it proves to be very difficult. It's not that easy. To return to the analogy of the scale, there is a way to balance the scale, and many of you are probably ahead of me on this, and that is to simply take the weights off of both sides, and then its inherent nature is to just be balanced through no effort other than to remove the weights. And there's something about that, you know, that seems to be relevant to an attitude, something about that that we can bring to meditation. If we let go of doing, we just sit there in deep faith and let go of doing, trying to put something on one side of the scale or the other to get what we think we want, but let things slide off, I let them go, I think that gives the heart-mind, for want of a better word, to a chance to convey its inherent nature of balance and completeness, which is best not to name, but just let be. It can't be created because it's fundamentally there already. It's like silence. You can't create silence. All you can do is stop making the noise, and it's there. I use the word silence. Sometimes we use stillness, peacefulness, centeredness, all sorts of different words to try to point to something. But essentially, they're not it. They're what seems to be an approximation. But it's a bit like trying to convey the meaning of zero by likening it to other numbers. If I have zero here and a million way out there, I'd say, well, there's a big, you know, that's really far away. Well, if we have 10 here, say, well, that's a lot closer to zero, you know. If we have one, well, that's getting a lot closer. And, you know, a half, we'll even get it. Well, we're getting there, you know. But if you look at it, no matter where you are, you can always divide it in half forever. For eternity upon eternity, you can just keep going. And you realize fundamentally you're not getting any closer than you were in the beginning. Because zero has a quality that makes it fundamentally different than all the numbers that surround it. But it seems like we're getting there. And in the same way, to describe this place that I'm talking about, this place to sit, yes, silence, stillness, peacefulness, seem to point to it. But it's not it. I'm not talking about a state of mind that has qualities. It's a placeless place where you don't seek any state of mind or the experience of that state of mind. We're so mind-oriented that I want to have a state of mind and experience it as such. In this place, you have quit the hunt for experience. And the more you can touch that place, the more you'll be able not to lose touch with it. When there are those aspects of practice that do involve the effort of being aware of our actions, of learning from our experience, and other intellectual aspects of practice, they're all good and useful, but what matters is kind of the underlying assumption about it all, or the heart from where it all comes. And then these things that are more of the mind are not done with an underlying or implicit rejection of ourselves as we are, or a grasping for what we imagine will be better, but simply because that is the flow of existence that we want to be. And you notice I didn't say we want to know. It's something we want to be. We want to manifest. Practice for practice sake. So River Master Jiu kept pulling us back to where we might otherwise wander off into other areas that seem maybe more interesting. And to some extent she was perhaps Dogen-esque in her insistence on Zazen as the core of it all. Wholeheartedly do Zazen. This is a bit of a side, but I wanted to mention it anyway. I read this past year one of Dogen's short talks that he gave to his monks, which was recorded by his chief disciple, Koan Ajo. And Dogen, you know, is known for being very strict and puritanical. And the story starts off with Dogen saying something along the lines of, monks shouldn't read things, you know, which if you stop there, okay, there he is, Dogen, you know, just Zazen only. But then he says, but if they do read things, they should read stories of the, you know, prominent monks that preceded them. Okay, so he sort of backed off a little. He said, above all, they should not read popular works, which, you know, the equivalent today might be novels, but these are probably more classical stories. Above all, they should not read popular works. He said, as for me, I do much too much of the latter and I should stop. I said, oh. Maybe he was a little more human than we've been led to believe. In any case, River Master Jiu arrived in around 69, and by 1970 had established the temple here. She was passing through and stopped, as I remember the story, stopped at Marilyn's, which was a restaurant on the south end of town, had a stagecoach in front of it. I don't know what it's called now. But the waitress told her about this place that was up for sale for the grand sum of about $60,000. And she and the people she was traveling with and some other resources they had managed to scrape up the $60,000. In 70, you know, she was up here. And as long as I knew her, there was always the feeling of just taking things one day at a time. She was always content just to simply live the contemplative life and help those who came, whether they stayed, became monks, or were lay people who found it helpful to come when they could. I never had any sense of her wanting more, a bigger organization, or more recognition. It was just one day at a time, and the community grew. Mind you, it was kind of a perfect storm of her being here and young people, you know, just oozing out of the woodwork, looking for a place to study, and there not being many places. You know, as I said, there was Rochester and here that I knew about in the whole country. Now, there was, you know, San Francisco Zen Center and probably other places, but it's not like it was today. You know, I haven't a clue what I'd do if I were looking for a place to, you know, how to choose. It's like having a television with 500 channels. Like, it was simpler then. Out of curiosity, I had someone add up the number of years of practice of all the monks that are still practicing in our order, or who were otherwise ordained by River Master Jiu and still practicing at monks as monks. And it came to over 2,000 years of accumulated monastic practice. And I said, wait a minute, let me see that. And yeah, I mean, we have 30 monks who have been at it for over 30 years. That's 900 years, you know, just right there. Most of them are in the mid-30s. 7 of them are 40 years plus. And that's not to count the years of practice of the countless number of laity who have come and made the Dharma central to their lives and have contributed to what we are as an order on all levels. Nor does it include those who are no longer monks, but the majority of which I believe are still practicing, each in their own way. And that 2,000 years of accumulated experience is quite a resource for those interested in learning from it. From those monks who are here at the Abbey, or here at Throssell, or the other temples of the order. Amongst ourselves, we have noticed many of us approaching old age, if not already in it. And of course, the reality of this situation can't be denied. We cannot pretend that we are still the younger generation that we once were, nor can we escape the characterization of being a community of older people by the current generation. We do have younger monks. And in the early days, there were older monks, but essentially we were a younger community, and now we're an older community for the most part. So there's no denying that. What I can do, however, is point out the resource of wisdom that is there by those who have kept at it for year after year after year after decade after decade. We're all in line to be old. It's just that some of us are closer to the front. And there is no getting out of that line. Most of us would probably not get in a plane, strap on a parachute, and willingly jump out. We'd say, no way, no thank you. But there is a great jump at the end of life that we all must make, We're all clipped inexorably to that line. And you don't get the wisdom to make that jump with a peaceful heart overnight. If you wish to slip into the kingdom of death as River Master Jiu did, do not waste time in gaining the wisdom of hell to do so. Now, of course, as the Abbey is now, and as the Order is now, as Throssell is, and the many temples of the Order is as they are now, Rev. Master G did not personally build them herself. That was done by the people who showed up over the decades, who worked to create what we have now. It was and always will be a group effort, a Sangha effort. However, my view is that there was something about how River Master G was that contributed greatly to whatever success you can say we've had. The first thing that comes to mind is her friendliness and open-heartedness, and her genuinely caring about the success of those around her. Her sense of acceptance of you as you were, without judgment. However, she had a job to do as abbess and master of most of the monks at that time, and she could not do her job. So at times she could be very direct in giving her teaching, which could sting, but when it was done, it was gone. That was the end of it. The visible appearance of acceptance and lack of judgment reappeared. Many a day I saw her give hard teaching to someone in the morning, and then the next time she saw them, it was, "Come on in, lass," or "lad," you know, as the case may be, or may it have been. And I saw her at times in a difficult human bind when matters of Dharma had to take precedent over the feelings of people she did care very much about. Many times, when she could, she was willing to bend the rule for the ultimate benefit of a person. The person at those times was more important than the rule. But of course, she could only bend up to a certain point. Was she perfect every time in executing these things? I don't think she would claim to do so, so I won't claim that for her. She herself said there were things she would do differently if she were given a chance to do them again. She was a human being who was learning how to do her job and about herself as she went along. We all have to do that. We have to wait till tomorrow to live tomorrow, and who knows what tomorrow is going to bring. But if things were difficult or challenging between you and her, if you gave it a chance, the background heart of caring and acceptance always rose to the surface. But as I said, the norm was that it was always there. But sometimes things got kind of tangled up and bumpy because we're human beings, and she was too. She seemed to have an understanding of human nature that seemed to me to be greater than would have come from her own life experience. Although I say that in recognition that my understanding of her life before I knew her was very incomplete. When I came, I felt I was coming to a place that didn't have the feeling of an institution where people came and went, but more of a place where I could lead a religious life with continuity and day-to-day stability. For want of better words, it was a home, and I was part of a religious family of people committed to doing the real inner work. Although, at times, things were very interesting. I just used the interesting word. In that we were, for the most part, young people who had more energy than sense at times. although time has shown us that having more energy than sense at times does not discriminate when it comes to age, myself included. In any case, there was something about Reverend Master Jiyu to me that imparted a familial sense, for which I was and am grateful. She showed great faith in the basic practice and a certainty that did not close the door on her going further in her own practice. On her certainty, I remember once when I was a new monk asking her a question about something, I don't know what it was, but she said, I don't know. And something about the fact that she was willing to say, I don't know, that, you know, with, whew, here's someone who's not going to try to pull the wool over my eyes and pretend to know everything, but was certain, still had that certainty within not knowing everything, you know. It somehow grew a bit of faith in me. It could have been used growing. Add to her certainty, her insistence on keeping true to the source, and I was glad to be here. It was the right time and the right place for me, and I was glad she was there. It was a good fit. It wasn't a good fit for everybody, which is not a failing on anybody's parts. You know, we're all different people, and what works for some doesn't work for another. That's just the way it is. I don't have any regrets other than I wish I could have been a better disciple. I wish I had figured out sooner than I did that the master-disciple relationship was less about how good the master was than it was about the quality of my discipleship. I'm glad to have practiced with all those who came and stayed or left, as the case may be. And there were many over the years. But I think once one has sat down to meditate and truly let go of oneself, that's the line that once you've crossed, I don't know that you can never pretend you haven't ever crossed it. Especially if you've had any genuine insight into what's on the other side of that line. So, as I said, those who have left, I believe, almost certainly have carried on in their own ways. I'm grateful that River Master Jiyu followed in the footsteps of those who preceded her, and made her own footsteps in which we can follow as we make our own footsteps in which those who will follow us will find. Each person, monk or laity, benefits from the foundation laid by others who came before, and at the same time we're all the founder of that which we pass on to those who follow us. And the size of the footsteps, the size of the foundation wall, are not the important thing, nor should we underestimate the effect one person can have or one kind word or action. What matters is the purity of heart, the depth of humility, compassion, and forgiveness, and the courage to do what needs to be done, both inwardly and outwardly, one day at a time. So whether you've been here for 45 years or just walk through the door today and wonder what you've stumbled into, thank you all for being here and contributing each in your own way. And that applies to any that are listening to this talk. Your contribution will benefit others as well as yourselves, inevitably. If you are yet to vote, I wish you luck with all that. I believe that as a general rule, maybe not an absolute rule, that the role of religion is to help people learn how to find answers to certain questions within their own hearts and not tell them what they should find there, especially since doing so can turn people away who might have different views and who, after all, have come here to find something within themselves much more significant than political affiliation. Life will go on after Tuesday, and Wednesday will be a good day for being grateful to be alive on our sparkling blue planet and for encountering the Dharma, which shows a way to have a still and peaceful heart throughout the changeableness of life. So, thank you all for coming. Thank you.